Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine, where we're chatting to Daisy Goodwin this week. Daisy has created some of the biggest TV shows around and is back with a brand new novel. It's called Diva. We talk through thorough research, which included singing lessons. Also, whether you're an architect or a gardener. And you can hear how novel writing is different from creating TV drama.
The thing about making TV shows is they're unbelievably collaborative. I mean, you're working with lots of people and, you know, you're running a team or you're looking at stuff. And it's not, if you're making non-fiction, then you're looking at stuff and you have to kind of edit it into a shape. If you're making drama, you've still got to, your original script can be taken in very many different ways by the actors and by the director. But when you're writing a novel, it's just you. And that is, can be very lonely, but it can also be incredible freedom. So I think I started writing novels as a way of escaping from the world of telly.
There is more with Daisy Goodwin on this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to the show. My name is Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine, where we take a look through an author's working day, over 300 episodes of in-depth chats with some of the best authors around. We see how, when, and where they get to work. What do they do? How do they plan their life and their space to give them the best chance of getting words down on the page? This week, we're chatting to Daisy Goodwin. Now, as a TV producer and screenwriter, she created Grand Designs, home redevelopment show, I guess. It's bigger than that. It was a huge show over here in the UK. Also, Escape to the Country, which has been on telly for more than 20 years. She also created Victoria with ITV and PBS, historical drama with Jenna Coleman, that was, all about Queen Victoria. It was sold to 146 countries. She's published poetry, had three best-selling novels, My Last Duchess, The Fortune Hunter, and Victoria. All of those together have been translated into 17 languages. She's got a memoir out too. It's called Silver River, and is back with a fourth novel, Diva. It's all about Maria Callas, one of history's most famous singers. It looks at her life with Aristotle Onassis, the shipping magnate, how that ended with Onassis marrying the first lady, Jacqueline Kennedy. So it's historical fiction, and we talk about the research for it that went way beyond reading a few books. Also, how she weaved her ideas and character development into what really happened. You can hear about the adjustment in her brain to move from having ideas for telly, but then trying to have separate ideas to get down as fiction. We chat through her return to novels after 5 years away, and you can hear about the skirmish of getting her favourite seat to write in. Also, we hear about why the nationality of your editor can make quite a big difference too, and why she's mindful not to try and show off with her prose. It's all on the way with Daisy Goodwin, and we start as we do every week with what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
I normally write in a place called the London Library, which is in St James's Square, and if I get there early, which I try to do, then I get my favourite seat, which is overlooking St. James's Square, and it's, I can see treetops, I can see people walking around St. James's Square, walking their dogs, going to work, doing whatever they're doing. I once saw the Queen getting out of a car, and it's a great place to sit. And behind me, there are about 17 million books. So I feel like I'm in the right place. And the other great thing about it is that there's a sort of line of desks. I sit at one end and I can see other people writing at the other desks. So whenever I'm tempted to kind of stop and do absolutely nothing, I see these other people typing furiously away and I get back to it.
It's interesting you saying that you want your favourite seat by the window. I've chatted to a few authors through the years that will go to the London Library and they always describe having their favourite seat. Is there somewhat of a skirmish to find where you want?
I'll say, yeah. It's kind of people line up on the steps at 9:30 and when it opens at May, rush in and try and get their favourite spot. I mean, on a Monday morning, it can be very difficult. By Friday, nobody cares. Everybody's left. But I don't really mind, but I do like sitting there because I feel right, you know, I'm here, I'm done, I can just work. So that's my... But, you know, if I have to go somewhere else, I don't sulk for very long.
Is it the London Library that... Is it that location that draws you to write somewhere else? Or is it... Are you just not a fan of writing at home?
I suppose I used to work in an office and I like the idea of a separation between home and work. And, you know, at home there is always something else to do. Whereas if I go to the library, I know that I've got X amount of time and I'm just going to sit there and do whatever I have to do. I mean, I can write at home, but I don't enjoy it as much as writing at the library. I've got everything I need at the library and it means that I'm sort of, you know, there are people to talk to. I kind of miss the everyday, you know, chit-chat of being in an office. And I get that to some extent at the library. So that's the other reason I go there. It sounds a bit weird to go to a library for chit-chat. But I think that sort of, you know, the kind of meaningless conversations that make up one's day, they're quite hard to have if you're sitting at home. So I like to do that. And also the other great thing about the library is you can't make a phone call. So, you know, I can happily not answer the phone. That's less of a problem now than it used to be, but I'm because nobody makes phone calls anymore. But the library is kind of the place where I feel secure. And, you know, if I've only gone there to work, so if I'm not working, then what am I doing, sort of thing. Whereas at home, I could be, you know, there are always bits and pieces to do. There's procrastination is more likely at home. Let's put it that way.
You mentioned no one making phone calls anymore, but the distraction still goes with you because we message all the time, we email all the time. How do you try and stay free of that when you've taken yourself somewhere else to work?
Well, my daughter, who's also a writer, is very, very stern, and she leaves her phone in her locker. I don't do that. I don't respond to things. When I'm really working hard, I switch it off. If I'm in the flow, I switch it off.
You said that you take everything with you. And I guess when you work at home, right, I know that a lot of authors have their creature comforts around them. So perhaps it's something on the desk. Perhaps it's very specific research books or a notebook or post-it notes all around you. You're not having that in this separate space. What do you need to write?
Now you're making me feel... No, I somebody described writing to me as you're either an architect or a gardener. And an architect plans everything out first and the gardener kind of throws some seeds in and sees what happens. And I guess I'm a gardener. So if I need any book, it'll be there in the library because it's got everything. If I need anything else, then, you know, I'll do it when I'm at home, but really I don't really need anything else because, yeah, I mean, I just like to get going. And, you know, if it's a good day, I don't want to stop. And I don't need, I mean, I might have a sheaf of notes with me. I might have a structure, a loose structure I've got. But usually I just start writing and see what happens.
Quite often I speak about, because you said a good day, quite often I'll look at that retroactively with someone and saying, how do you know if it was a good day? But is there a reverse of that? When you're there in the morning lining up outside the London Library, do you get a feeling like it is going to be a good day?
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, I think sometimes you do. You go in with a sort of positive mental attitude, especially when you know you're nearly at the end. And when you're nearly at the end, it's like, I think Edith Wharton described it as a kind of headlong rush to the finish. You know, there's a kind of, the beginning is fine, the middle is this kind of barren desert that goes on forever, and then suddenly you see the end in sight and you just hurtle towards it. I always know I'm going to have a good day when I'm, you know, when the end is in sight. I don't know. Sometimes the day can be very surprising. You know, sometimes you can feel totally stuck. And then what I tend to do is to wander around the library looking at random at various books. And I don't know, just the act of turning my attention elsewhere means that quite often, you know, it'll get solved in my head without me realizing it. Or I talk to someone and something will trigger it. I mean, it's alchemy, really. I don't really know how it works, but it's by talking to somebody else about something else or reading something else, you know, just taking yourself away from the knot you're trying to untangle is often the best way to solve it.
We get quite niche and nerdy in this show. So if it is just you and your laptop, what software are you writing on, Daisy? And also, what fonts are you using?
Oh, my goodness. Wow, that is a really niche and nerdy question. Well, when I'm writing prose, when I'm writing novels, I used to do everything on a... I used to have a sort of special novel writing app. I can't remember what it was called, but then my publisher just said, please don't use that again. It's too complicated. Just use Word. So now I just use Word, which is, I know that sounds pathetic, but he almost cried when I sent him my last novel in this kind of, in the format suggested by this. It's called Highland 2, which you can write screenplays in and novels and whatever, and it's brilliant, but the receiver does not like it, so I've gone back to Word. And when I'm writing screenplays, again, I love using Highland 2, but again, it causes havoc with the producers who can't understand it. So I've gone back to using Final Draft. And my font, well, I think I'm probably a Times New Roman girl, although perhaps I haven't really thought about it enough. maybe I don't like Courier. I think Georgia, I sometimes use Georgia or Garamond. Yes. I mean, I don't know. What are the popular fonts? I mean, I'm so worried about getting my word count done that I'm not, you know, really concentrating on the font. I know I sometimes look at other people's fonts and think, goodness me, that's lovely. But I haven't actually been motivated to do anything about it. So, yeah, suggest me a font to start off with and I might use it.
Oh, I don't think you need. I think Georgia is a good staple, I would say.
Yeah. It's my middle name too, so I always feel.
There you go. Yeah. The only font thing that is moderately interesting is quite often people will switch fonts when it comes to edit. So they're seeing it almost through different eyes.
Oh, interesting. So they do the whole thing in a different font?
Yeah. They might, you know, write in Times New Roman, then switch it up to Georgia, Garamond, as it comes to edit, just because it helps them perhaps see things that they've got grown used to.
Right. I've got it. You see, when I go back to edit, I always look at it and think, who wrote this?
Kind of in my work. Someone else must have done that.
No. Sometimes I just think, gosh, did I write that? I don't remember writing that. It's a weird thing. I get up, I have my breakfast, I do some exercise, and then I will probably either cycle or get the tube, depending on the weather, to the library, where I like to get there by 10. And then I will write, and then I will sit down and write until I've done probably 1,000 words or 6 or 7 pages if I'm writing a screenplay. So that's the way I do it. I give myself a target and I'm not allowed to kind of move until I've done that. And then when I've done that, I will enjoy myself for the rest of the day. I tend not to go back and edit until I've finished. I tend to do all my research and, I do all that first. And I make notes and I kind of let it sort of marinate in my head. And then when I come to write, and I'll talk about it with my editor and I'll sort of think about it. And then when I come to write, I just start and sort of plunge in, which I find is the most, I don't know, it's probably not the best way of doing it, but it's the way I do it. When I'm writing a screenplay, I'm slightly more ordered and structured, particularly because when you're writing a screenplay, obviously it's got to be a certain length and, there are beats you have to hit and, you suddenly think, oh, God, this character hasn't spoken for a while and that kind of thing. So it's slightly more technically demanding. This last novel I wrote, I hadn't written a novel for about five, six years. So it was quite a thing to get back into it. But once I did and I felt I was writing well, it was great. And I love the freedom of it. I love the way that you can just go anywhere, do anything, have as many characters on the page as you want or none. And that is such a relief. And then when I go home, I might go, I'll probably spend the rest of the day sort of buying more books, possibly. I buy a lot of books and then I'll go home. I'll probably cook dinner. I love cooking. And I'll probably read something or watch something before I go to bed. I tend to watch movies rather than serial dramas because I don't like the temptation of binging. I like a sort of closed narrative. So I can sort of feel that's it. And if I'm reading a really exciting novel, I won't read it before I go to bed because I know that I will stay up all night reading it. So I'll try and read something that's a bit less exciting, some nonfiction perhaps. And then, I fall asleep and hello, a new day comes. I don't really have any. I'm a great believer in if you're really stuck, then go for a walk or do something like that, or just have another look at everything. But that's my day.
The 1,000 word aim for the day. If you're there, if you're focused, if you arrive at the London Library for 10, how long is that usually taking you?
Well, it depends. If I'm writing, when I'm writing an article, I can do it in about an hour and a half. If I'm writing prose, if I'm writing my novel, it probably will take me, on a good day, I'll be finished by lunchtime. On a bad day, it'll take me, till 4 o'clock. It just depends. And sometimes I get distracted in the morning. And then if I get distracted, then I start again at 2 and I'll probably finish it by 4:30, I would imagine.
And in that afternoon space, your free time.
Yeah.
How hard is it to switch the idea off, whatever it is you've been working on? Do you find yourself, I don't know, what you do, roaming around the corridors of Hatchards looking for books and you see, things creeping in?
Yeah, I'm always looking for ideas. We're all writers, all creative artists are sponges to some extent. So I try and fill up my, you know, brain, the sort of holes in my mind with as much interesting stuff as possible. I mean, I try consciously, I don't know, and I try and get as many different kind of cultural references as I can. So the great thing about the London Library is I can walk to the RA, I can walk to the National Gallery, I can go and look at paintings, I can, you know, go and listen to a concert, I can do all these things without too much trouble, and I love doing all of that. And then if I'm somewhere else, sometimes I go to the country, and then I'll just go for incredibly long walks and try and figure out. And possibly the great thing about being not in London for that is that then it's okay to talk to yourself and nobody thinks you're actually mad. Because I quite often like doing...
Hello.
I like talking to myself in... sorry, my husband's just walked in. I like talking to myself as I walk around, you know, trying to do bits of dialogues and stuff like that.
The 1,000-word limit is strange because, I mean, it's no surprise you are one of many, many writers who aims for 1,000 words a day. And it's only just struck me that although it's 1,000, right, it's still a random number. Like, do you think if you would set yourself 2,000 words, you could maybe...
I have done that in the past. When I had to write something very quickly, I was writing 2,000 words a day, and it did practically kill me. So I've sort of learnt that 1,000 words is... I think it's a reasonable amount. And if I'm really cooking with gas, then I'll carry on. I won't just stop. But... yeah, I suppose what it does is it gives you permission to stop. If you don't want to stop, then that's great. But it does give you permission to stop. And I feel that that writing is, you know, it is about effort as well as inspiration. I'm sure everyone says this, but, I mean, it's a bit like any kind of exercise. To begin with, it's quite hard, and you know, everything aches, and it's really finding it difficult. But if you persevere, there comes a point when it feels easier, and suddenly, you know, you don't want to stop, and that's the state one's always aiming for. And if you're in that state, then you'll just carry on for as long as you feel happy. You know, and that doesn't happen that often. That maybe happens, I don't know, once a week. But when you get into that, you know, the famous state of flow, then you never want to stop.
You mentioned starting writing novels again after a 5-year break, and that was a little tricky at the start. What was it that you needed to almost remind yourself how to do? What did you find tricky about getting back into this way of working, writing prose, writing novels, that maybe you had lost a touch of, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, I think the thing about writing prose is that, well, I mean, I'd been doing everything with, you know, screenplays are all about, it's all about dialogue, but it's also about sort of dramatic situations. And you need all of those in a novel, but in a novel, you also need scene setting. You need much more. You need to tell the reader more than you would in a screenplay. So one of the things I had to kind of consciously make myself do was remind, you know, I have to tell people what a character looks like, or give them a sense of how they dress and things like that, because all of that's done for you. It's done for a viewer, whereas it isn't for a reader. So it's just about things like that. And you have to make it's sometimes not enough to leave the dialogue without some kind of explanation of what it means, which is something I wouldn't ever do, you know, in a screenplay. It's very clunky. But in a novel, sometimes you have to say, you know, she sighed, or, you know, there was a laugh in her voice, or something like that, so that the reader knows what you mean. I mean, obviously you don't want it to be too laid out, but you can't leave out as much as you would in a screenplay.
Now, your kind of the story is quite interesting. I wonder, so you had done a lot of work in TV, and there's a lot going on with Grand Designs and latterly then with Victoria, and you're also writing novels. I guess, what was it that you wanted to be when you were starting out, and at what point did you decide, in amongst everything else that's going on telly, I want to write a novel as well? What was that moment?
Okay, well, I think when I left university, I went to film school in America for 2 years, and I wanted to write screenplays. And then when I came back to England, I got a job at the BBC, and I found myself in the BBC Arts Department. And I found myself making films about writers because that's really what I was interested in. And I made a film about Kingsley Amis when he was 70. I made a film about, writers and their wills and, you know, sort of their last testament, as it were, and various things like that. And I began to realise that, in fact, I was making films about writers because actually I wanted to write myself. But I hadn't really given myself permission to do that. I don't know why, but I was still in TV telling stories. And I mean, TV is about telling stories, and, you know, a show like Grand Designs, although it isn't scripted, is entirely about a human drama, of course, because it starts with an idea. You know, you go through this, you know, there's a protagonist who wants to achieve his or her dream. And then, you know, there are peaks and troughs. And then finally you end up with what you hope is a happy ending. You do if you're a TV producer. if you're a novelist, you wouldn't mind, but kind of all collapsed at the end of the show. But for TV, you need to see the house. So I had an instinct for story, I think. And it was about, well, first I wrote a memoir when I was in my 30s. And I think it was writing that made me feel that I could write fiction if I wanted to. And so I wrote the memoir, and then, which is called Silver River. And then about 5 years later, I wrote my first novel, which was a historical novel called, in England, it was called My Last Duchess. In America, it was called The American Heiress. And I don't know, that just, for some reason, it just happened. And I must have been in my early 40s, but it just kind of, I suddenly found I could write. And I didn't really think about it too much. I just sat down, and one day I started doing it, and it was, you know, it was great. And that was I was working full time, so I was writing at weekends and so forth. And when it was finished, it was sold to America. My American editor said to me, Daisy, I love this book. It's like Henry James without the boring bits. But I hate the ending because it's a gothic ending. And this is a kind of, you know, it's a comedy of manners. And she was totally right, of course. And that's the thing about American editors. They're very outspoken, old school American editors. But they know what they think, and they've got a reason to think it. And she was totally right. It was the wrong ending, and I'd sort of struggled with it. I knew it was the wrong ending, but I didn't really know how to fix it. And once she said that, it was like, oh, okay, I know what to do now. So I rewrote the ending. I rewrote the last third of the book, and then it became a much better book. So that was very lucky that I met her. I think the thing I learned through writing that, and through everything I've done since, is that all writing is really rewriting. You can never finish something. I mean, I could go on fiddling with everything I've done indefinitely. But there's a point where you just think, no, enough is enough.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We're back with more from Daisy in just a sec. Now, if you're enjoying the show and if you've learned anything over 300 episodes that has helped the way you work, the way you plan, maybe change the way your day looks, well, I'd love you to support us on our Patreon page. By pledging, becoming a backer at patreon.com/writersroutine, you join a brilliant little writing community that we've got over there. And for that, you get merch. There is bonus content, book review videos, behind the scenes stuff. There is even a way for your book to sponsor this show. So if you've put something out recently, if it's not had the pushing and the marketing that I am certain it deserves, let me do what I can for you. Let me do that plugging. And I know that things are tight at the moment. I really appreciate whatever you can pledge and back us with. It doesn't have to be a lot. Just a few dollars a month really helps us keep going. If you've listened for a while, if you listen every week, I really love that. And the way to make sure it stays that way and that I can keep bringing you these chats with the best authors around as often as I can is by becoming a backer and supporting the show at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it then with Daisy Goodwin chatting through the making of her new novel, Diva. It's all about one of history's most famous opera singers, Maria Callas, and her life with Aristotle Onassis, the shipping magnate, how that ended with Onassis marrying the First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy. We talk about why she's careful about what she's reading when she's writing, all about the extensive research for the novel, not just reading, but also taking singing lessons. And we get back to it with the adjustment of ideas to go so long creating and having them for TV shows and screenwriting there. What do you need to do to have ideas for novels? Does that require much change?
Yes, I suppose there's always been a part of me which enjoyed, I mean, I'm very interested in history. So, you know, and I like writing about the past. So maybe that's where, you know, so maybe it felt like a different place I was going to when I was writing than, you know, making a grand science or something like that. And also the thing about making TV shows is they're unbelievably collaborative. I mean, you're working with lots of people and, you know, you're running a team or you're looking at stuff and it's not, you know, if you're making nonfiction, then you're looking at stuff and you have to kind of edit it into a shape. If you're making drama, you've still got to, you know, your original script can be taken in very many different ways by the actors and by the director. But when you're writing a novel, it's just you. And that can be very lonely, but it can also be incredible freedom. So I think I started writing novels as a way of escaping from the kind of, you know, the world of telly. I mean, not that I didn't love it. It's just, you know, you have to do everything. You have to think about what you're saying to people. You have to make them enthusiastic. You have to be either selling or you know, you have to manage people. There's a whole host of skills, which some of which I have, some of which I really haven't got. But you don't need any of that for writing a novel. You do for when you have to go out and sell it, publicise it, but you don't when you're actually writing.
What skills are transferable then? So what did making telly and writing telly teach you about how novels should be written and structured and plotted and researched and everything there?
Well, I think character's very important. I think you need to know who a character is. I think one of the things I'm quite good at with screenplays is, you know, all my characters feel different. And I think that's something I can do with novels as well. And, you know, I suppose what I've learned is that the people you remember, that there's just something about them that makes you remember them. And I've tried always to kind of find the essence of a character and keep that in mind. It's usually a facial tic or just something that always puts them in my head. And I have to say that maybe this is, I mean, I don't know whether everybody does this, but I do tend to see scenes in my head. So it's almost like I'm describing something that I've seen when I write. And I think pace is something that you learn from TV, you know, just getting on with it. I mean, I say that, it may be that lots of people read my books and think they're incredibly slow, but I try and, you know, I try and justify every word. And what else? I try to keep my language kind of, I try to use words. Oh, this is going to sound, I try to be democratic in my language, I suppose. I mean, I love words and I could spend hours kind of fiddling about with them, but I don't want to kind of make anything inaccessible.
How does that work then? Is it the case of you thinking something and thinking, oh, maybe there's a better way I can articulate that makes it more accessible, as you say?
Yes, I mean, you know, there are words that, I'm saying this and now I'm trying to think when I've done it, but I suppose I think there are times, I mean, I know there are lots of words that I overuse, and but I try when I go back, and I'm looking over what I've written, I try to make it as clear as I can. And sometimes there are words where you think you're just using this word as a kind of, because it's a beautiful word, but is it the right word? Do you know what I mean? And I don't know. Somebody said my prose was very plain. And I didn't, you know, I never thought of it like that. But in a way, I just don't want it to get too much in the way of the story. I like my dialogue to be snappy. I like that to have something going on in it. But, you know, it's all a work in progress. And I think what I'm good at is, well, I don't know what I was going to say what I'm good at. Well, I think I'm probably quite good at character. I'm quite good at dialogue. And I have a kind of fairly comic take on things. I mean, not comic, ironic take on things. And sometimes that can get in the way of the story I'm telling. So I have to kind of tamp it down. You know, when I was writing this last novel, you know, Maria I love her, but I'm also, you know, there are moments when she's ridiculous, and I have to kind of stop myself from kind of looking back and almost making fun of her. So it's a complicated thing, that.
Does that happen first time round? As in when you are writing your first draft, are you trying to make it as accessible and as snappy as possible? Is this something that's happening as you're editing later?
No, I think it happens more when I'm editing. I mean, normally when I'm in my first draft, I'm trying not to allow any kind of judgment or anything like that interfere with my writing. I mean, I just want to get it down. And then I go back and think, oh, is that just me showing off that paragraph? Because I have to be terribly careful about what I read when I'm writing, because, you know, you can get very sort of seduced by certain styles. So I try to read a lot of nonfiction, actually. The only exception I make is for Jane Austen, because if I could imitate her, I'd be very happy. The first time I thought it would be a novel was probably in lockdown. And, you know, I had a number of thoughts about what I was going to do next. And I just had watched this fantastic documentary about Callas called Callas in Her Own Words. And I knew a lot about her music, but I didn't know as much about her life. I knew enough, but I didn't really know. And I started researching it, and I thought, well, this would be, she's a wonderful subject for a drama. I mean, for a novel. And I just, the more I got into it, the more I thought, oh, this is fantastic. And then my editor in America just said, not Hope, who was my first editor, but a new editor called Charlie, said, well, I think this would be a great, you know, I said, well, I've been thinking about Maria Callas, and he said, that's a fantastic idea. I would love you to write a novel about Maria Callas. And he said, have you thought about starting it here? And he suggested starting it on the night when Callas goes out in Paris to Maxime's, a restaurant in Paris, while her lover of 9 years, Anassis, marries Jackie Kennedy on his private island, Skopios in Greece. And she goes out that night and she puts on the biggest show of, you know, the best performance of her life. And I thought, God, what a brilliant way to start it. And doing that basically just gave me the, you know, from then on, I just plowed on from there, because the sort of structure became clearer. I was very grateful for that suggestion.
Well, let's talk about the structure and, I guess, the idea generation, the plot of it, because as you've done with novels in the past, you're, and probably more so in this one, you're weaving fact and fiction. You know, you're sat there, you've got this idea of Maria Callas putting on this fantastic show as her lover marries one of the most famous women in the world. How are you making the fiction in that situation? What are you thinking? What questions are you asking to get a plot going?
Well, I suppose I'm thinking, how is she feeling? How is she doing it? What is she wearing? You know, how does she, I mean, you know, I suppose what I instantly thought was, she's going to prepare herself for this performance as she would for going on stage. So it's all about what she's wearing, how she makes herself up, you know, her public face, and, you know, the idea that the entire world knows what's happening, and it's vital that she maintains face in this kind of hour of crisis. And then I suppose, you know, and you're thinking, why is it so important? And then you kind of want to, and then I thought, well, from there, you need to know kind of who she is, but you start at a moment of crisis, because I think that's always a good place to start. And she gets through the night, even though she's challenged by this kind of malevolent demon from her past, Elsa Maxwell. And so, you know, all the ingredients of the story are there, really. You know about, you know, she's, you know who she is, you know she's a singer, you know she's performing, you know that Elsa is this kind of, is a nemesis, you know that Anassis is the love of her life, and you know that she feels utter despair, but she's putting on a show. And then we go back, and then there's lots of shifts in time, but then I decided to go back to the moment where she's at the height of her powers. She's coming, which is about 10 years earlier, and she's coming to sing in New York for the first time, as a kind of diva, as a sort of lead singer. And that's a huge moment for her for lots of reasons. And, you know, she's probably the most famous opera singer in the world. She's the most highly paid woman in the world. But, you know, it's a very difficult moment for her because she's scared. And, you know, there's a little prologue that I start the book with, where she's 18 and she's running through the streets in Greece, and she's singing at the top of her voice, and her singing teacher tells her off because she says, you know, she says, oh, am I singing? Am I out of tune? She says, no. But if you sing like that, you won't have any voice left. And you know, your voice is like a sort of an amphora full of golden coins. And, you know, you've got these beautiful golden coins. You can spend them as you like. But once you've spent them, there won't be any more. And so that sort of sets the clock ticking, because what we realize when she's in New York, that although she's the greatest singer in the world and everything else, she's also terrified that her voice isn't going to come, you know, that the voice is a kind of, you know, it's not entirely within her control. You know, it's a sort of, it's almost like the sacred goddess that, you know, the character she plays, Norma, in the opera Norma, worships. So there's a kind of strange quality about the relationship between Callas and her voice, which I was very keen to explore. So keen, in fact, that I took singing lessons, because I felt I couldn't write about it unless I'd understood how it worked.
How did that change? Well, how did singing lessons change your view of the character?
Well, it made me realise that if you're a singer of that calibre, you really can't do anything else. You can't, you know, you can't go near smoke. You can't really drink. You can't. Your life. You're like a ballerina, or, you know, or an athlete. You've got to keep yourself in peak physical condition all the time. You know, it's a very athletic skill, opera singing. Plus, you have to do it with, you know, dramatic ability. You've got to be able to invest this music with your personality. You've got to make people believe that you're a, you know, you're dying of consumption or whatever it is. And so it's unbelievable. It's like, you know, trying to, you know, do Shakespeare while running a marathon. I mean, it's an extraordinary skill. And what made Callas so amazing was that she could do both. She could act as well as she could sing. And that was something I found, you know, I've tried to express. But I think what I really learned from doing this is the sort of the feeling inside of, it doesn't matter how much you're training or whatever you've got to, as my singing teacher always used to say, you've got to think beyond the note, and you've got to just assume it's going to come. Because if you start thinking about it too much, you'll get the, you know, what do they call it in golf? You'll get the yips, and you won't be able to sing. So it's a very psychological state. So all of that is there. And, you know, there are times when Callas thinks she can't sing, and she's not ill. There's nothing wrong with her voice. It's simply because she's, you know, put herself in this frame of mind. And that means the voice literally isn't there. And I hadn't really understood that until I started to sing myself.
Now, coming from a screenwriting background, and especially with all the research you need to do, you said you need to know everything pretty much before you start. How much do you know about the plot, about the beginning, the middle, the end, all the beats that lie in between before you start writing the first sentence?
Well, with this one, I did know, because obviously I had the advantage of knowing. I think I knew where I was going to end it, which was that she was going to be her own woman again. And so that was helpful. But it, you know, I can't say that I'm somebody who has everything sort of plotted out in my head. I mean, it would be much easier if I did. But I did try and do that with my first novel, and I ended up rewriting it. So I feel sometimes, I mean, character will take you places that maybe you didn't expect. And you have to be sort of, well, I think my writing process is very instinctive. So, which is why I would never be able to write a detective novel, because I'm very instinctive. I sort of follow where I think, the characters will have a sort of life of their own. I always thought that was ridiculous when people said that, but actually they do have a life of their own. And I think you have to kind of corral them. You can't go off at too many tangents, but to have life, you've got to you know, sometimes I'll be writing and then a new character will occur to me and I'll just put them in and it's like, hooray, this is exciting. So, you know, the beats, yeah, I mean, I'm aware of the beats when I'm aware of the beats, but one of the pleasures of writing a novel is that you don't have to hit exact beats in the same way that you do with a screenplay. But I think, and the other extraordinary thing about the difference between drama and writing a novel is that a novel, you can tell one story really well, but in a drama, one story is, that'll take about 20 minutes. So you need so much else.
I guess lastly, because of the characters that you're writing about, be it through this, be it through something like Victoria, you must have a sense of what you want the audience to think about them, how, whether you want an audience to love a character, to hate a character, to be sympathetic towards a character. How does that get in the way of trying to portray them accurately and in three dimensions when maybe you're trying to lead an audience? Because those things can't always go hand in hand.
Good question. I mean, with Victoria, she was, I mean, you know, that started out, the idea was really this teenager, tiny, tiny teenager, surrounded by a sort of forest of older sort of snow-capped men. I think that's that was the image that was in my mind, and it sort of followed from there. So I think I was, you know, I was always on Victoria's side. With Maria, it's, yeah, I'm on Maria's side, but I mean, she's not, but I haven't sugarcoated a lot of the stuff about her. I mean, she's not, I haven't tried to make her likable. In fact, I would say, I mean, if you like her, then yeah, I think you feel for her. You may not entirely like her, but you certainly feel for her. I mean, I think she's a heroine, but she's not completely sympathetic. She's not lovable, possibly. But I don't really care about that, because what mattered to me with this book was that I wanted to make her, I wanted to write a book about a female genius. And, you know, I sort of think that we don't really care whether male geniuses are lovable, but we hold it against women if they're not, you know, sympathetic in a more sort of obvious way. You know, so for example, people always say to me, oh, you're right about Queen Victoria, but wasn't she such a bad mother? And it always makes me think, would you be asking that question if I was writing about Henry VIII? Would you be saying Henry VIII, but he was a terrible father? Do you know what I mean? And I sort of, that raises my hackles a bit. And with Maria, I suppose I felt slightly that, you know, a lot of things had been held against her, which she'd been a man would not have been interesting. So I mean, you know, that isn't really relevant to a novel, but it's something that I wanted to convey. It was a kind of, it was a world and an attitude and a sort of the way that she was, you know, the criticism of her was definitely gendered that I wanted to kind of get across. And I wanted people to see that, you know, she was doing nothing differently from anybody else, but because she was a woman, she was given, you know, she was monstered in the press in a way that is, I think, appalling. And I think it's all the more to her credit that she managed to continue, and she didn't, you know, she didn't dissolve. I think she was, I suppose I love the idea of a woman who's a warrior, really. Which is what she was.
Thank you so much to Daisy Goodwin for coming on the show. The new novel is Diva. It is out right now. There are many more books that she's published as well. You can find them all online. We will be back next week with a brand new author on the show. In the meantime, remember, you can support us, patreon.com/writersroutine. You could drop us a follow on X. We are at WritersPod there. And you can get in contact using the page over at writersroutine.com. Pretty straightforward to find. And I will see you next week with a brand new guest on the show. Until then, bye-bye.